Editor's note: the date of this interview is actually January 7th, 2011.
I'll introduce it and say, my name is Ann Smith, and I'm a volunteer with the Sam Proctor Oral History Program at the University of Florida. And I am sitting today, which is January 6th, 2011, with Scott Van Alstyne, and we're in his home in Gainesville, Florida. And Scott, why don't you give us your full name?
Actually, my full name is Walter Scott Van Alstyne. Van Alstyne's two words. It's a Dutch name.
Mm-hmm.
Like President Van Buren. I mean, it's, but they either want to cramp it together into one word, which is wrong, and I won't approve that. My ancestors would be spinning in their graves.
That's right. And where were you born?
I was born in East Syracuse, New York.
And when?
21 September 1922.
Okay. Well, now, we have on file your oral history that you did for the College of Law, and
that's the one that Sam sent somebody over.
Yes. Yeah. And so we have that on file. So the purpose of our interview today is to get your firsthand experiences of what took place as far as you were concerned in World War II. Now, one of my questions was, when you were growing up in your family, was there anyone in the military?
Not in recent years, but if you want to go back to the French and Indian War, there were plenty of them.
Oh, I see. But no one who might have influenced you? Okay.
No, other than being a small boy and hearing people talk. It was fascinating to me.
Well, now, when you were going to school as a small boy, did you have siblings?
Yes, I have. I had a sister who died a couple years ago at age 84.
And she was older or younger than you?
She was older.
Older
she
than you.
She was born in October 1918.
I see. And what did your father do for a living?
That's complicated. He was really a warrior engineer.
Uh-huh.
My father attended Syracuse University. And he, actually, out of that rather odd background, and including a large number of inherited properties, he had to be in the insurance business to insure all his real estate things. So he really became an insurance agent for himself.
Sure.
And that worked fine until the Great Depression, when everybody canceled all our insurance and we went broke.
Well, now, what year did you graduate from high school?
1939.
And so did you know anything at that time about what was going on in Europe or?
Oh, yes. By then, the newspapers had caught on that there was not only just the day of Hitler invading Europe, but that there was great tension and problems back and forth, and the newspapers were full of it.
And so as a high school student, you were aware.
Oh, and how. And in fact, as 1940-41 progressed, a great many young people, high school men, went over to Canada and joined the Royal Forces.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of them. I've got a photograph of me when I was going to be a hero.
in Canada?
Yeah, but my father came up there and got me out of it. You know, just a kid, 17 or 18.
Yeah, but everybody else was going.
They wanted people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so that was before you graduated or after?
That was after, but very close.
And so you were influenced by the newspaper and your peers, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And so when he came up...
And of course, by then we began to get sophisticated about politics, and everybody hated Hitler.
Yes.
Which was legit, but...
Yes. So he brought you back home, and then what did you do?
Went to school.
To where did you go?
Syracuse University.
Uh-huh. And so when did you get in the military? When did you join the military?
I can't hear you.
When did you join the service?
Oh, in December 1941.
And how did that come about?
I was drafted.
Oh. And where that was in Syracuse?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was the nearest big community.
And you were drafted into the Army, is that correct?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And so when did
I went to Fort Niagara, New York, which is a very old military post just north of Syracuse on Lake Ontario.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And so you were drafted, and where did you take your basic training?
Well, this may sound strange, but after I was drafted, I was sent to Jefferson Barracks, Missouri, which was just a generalized nothing. I mean, nobody said you were going to be an aviator or a machine gun. It was just, you learn how to put a rifle or present arms, that's all. That didn't last too long because from Jefferson Barracks, Missouri, I was in the company of another group of draftees. We were put on a train and, well, we were at Fort Niagara for a short time in transit. But we were sent to Jefferson Barracks, Missouri, which at that time became part of the Army Air Corps, not the Air Force. This was just a branch of the Army.
That's right.
And I had some notion from the RAF experience that I wanted to be a flaming pilot, the Herald. And turns out they weren't, by the time I got there, they weren't too interested in that. They were already cranking out pilots by the dozen. And so, but I stayed under the, call it the Aegis, A-E-G-I-S, of the Army Air Corps. And I was sent from there to Utah, to Fort Douglas, which was a training pool or sifting pool for freshman in the Army. And from there I went to Fort Geiger up in Spokane. That was a real Army base, Air Force. I mean, there were planes there.
Uh-huh.
And I ran into, as a matter of fact, I ran into a couple of guys I knew in high school that were machine gunners on one of those B-17s.
Well, let me ask you about any of that part of your basic training. Was that anything that you expected, or were you, was that?
No, I was disappointed because they were putting me in jobs as, I didn't want to be a mechanic in the Army Air Corps.
Yeah.
So.
And you were a private?
Yeah, I was a private, yes. And the thing was, our military was sort of a complicated mess. In the early days of World War II, the military had no real notion of a real Air Force. They did by the end of the war, but at the beginning it was everybody catch as can.
Sure.
And so from there, I was assigned at Fort Geiger, sometimes called Geiger Field, as a private. And I just was, it happened, one of the reorganizations was that the new Army Air Corps was to have engineers with it. Well, the only engineers the Army had at that time were combat engineers, which were part of the, normally the artillery and infantry, and didn't have a damn thing to do with the Air Force. But anyhow, a group of us were put on a train and we went down to Wendover, Utah, which was a Army training base. It's right on the border between, you could put 1 foot in Nevada and 1 foot in California or mm-hmm. Utah. And we went there, lived in tents, and went through a lot of exercises. What I didn't realize at the time, but I know now that I've served in a lot of capacities, well, I didn't know was the central authority of the Army was terribly concerned about the fighting in North Africa. And they wanted, they were going to need engineers. They didn't know whether to call them Air Corps people or
I see.
Army engineer people. It was a mess. So we went from, suddenly from Wendover, Utah, we were discovered we were headed for a port of embarkation of all things. And my battalion, which was a separate battalion in the engineers.
What battalion was it?
The 1881st Engineer Battalion.
Okay.
And we didn't know whether we were ground troops in combat or whether we were potential flyers or what. It was just of a mess. And so we went from there, from Wendover, we went to Camp Stoneman, California, which is in on the Sacramento River.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I don't think that cat turned this on. I'm cold. Where the heck did they put this?
There it is. It was down there. Is that what you're looking for?
You know, one like it, but it's a long, narrow thing.
I get it.
It's
there deep. It is. I see it.
You see it?
What you want to know?
That's it. Put it on medium. So, there we were on a train. Troop train headed to California. And
how long did that take, the crossing the...
Oh, we were there from March, April, somewhere in that area, 1942.
But I mean, how long did the trip on the train take?
Oh, I don't know, a couple days. And they had it was pretty well done, actually. They had one car fixed up as a food dispensing
uh-huh.
place. It wasn't a formal dining car.
Sure.
And we got to Camp Stoneman, which was really a temporary fort in World War II.
Uh-huh.
It's right on the Sacramento River, which is a big river. And they even had some temporary buildings already built for barracks, one-story, simple things.
Uh-huh.
And so while we were at Camp Stoneman and the powers that be were trying to figure out what to do with us and where to send us, and they were waiting for word from the other end
yeah.
where to send us, we had to go on a route marches. We had to, now this has nothing to do with the Air Corps, but we had to learn how to use bayonets. They brought in a gang of combat troops, and they said, listen, you ain't in the Air Corps anymore, buddy. Here's a rifle. So we had regular combat training and basic training right there.
Uh-huh.
And then finally the word came we're going to move, and we did. They loaded us on ferries and took us down the Oakland estuary. And there was a big civilian, what had been a luxury liner.
Yes.
The Mount Vernon, they call it the Mount Vernon, was the old President Roosevelt, I think, as I remember.
Uh-huh.
And became the Mount Vernon. The Army renamed everything
yes.
for their records. And I'll never forget going down that river with a pack with all my belongings, such as they were, into the side. Have you ever been around a big ship?
Yeah.
They have doors that people don't even know about that open in the side of the ship.
Wasn't that amazing?
Yeah, And then you walk in, and then you're directed by somebody to go to 11, 12 or something. So finally they closed all the doors, and we went off, and we began to learn by gossip that we were headed for Australia.
Really?
Well, after this mixed up, sloppy training, we didn't really know much about combat troops, but it was obvious somebody had the idea that we might be used there. The theory was, at Wendover Field, we were really being trained to protect the airport from being seized by the enemy. Now, this is ridiculous. You couldn't imagine the Germans dropping a battalion in the middle of a damn desert in Utah. But that's why we had to go through this railroad. Likewise, when we got to Sacramento, we had to do a lot of outside stuff in addition to bayonet training and everything else. Well, finally, the ship took off and we headed for Australia, the SS Mount Vernon. And it was a large cruise ship. It must have been, at least a couple thousand troops on board. There were some other units besides ours. It was 23 days to Sydney, Australia, right from dear old Sacramento, or shortly thereafter. So when we got to Sydney, I remember docking there. We landed at the Woolloomooloo docks. Sydney was a great port before the war. It was one of the big ones. Australia is a country that's always on the rim.
Yeah, that's right.
And they had, Sydney was the logical place to dock a ship of this size. And the Australians had former army units that we could use their facilities.
How was the crossing? Were people sick or was it a smooth crossing?
No. It was the Pacific's pretty calm as a rule.
Yeah, it was the Atlantic.
I can tell you this, coming back several years later with waves 30 and 40 feet high, that was not a smooth crossing.
Uh-huh.
But going over.
It was.
The Pacific got its name, Pacific, calm.
Yeah.
And that's who was it, Balboa? I don't know who it was. All those Spanish people were.
Uh-huh.
And so we landed in I'll tell you one story about it that it was interesting.
Okay.
Sydney has a natural protected entrance to its harbor.
Uh-huh.
And in that inner harbor is where all, in peacetime, the cruise ships and everything all were moored.
Uh-huh.
Here. And so about 3 days out of Sydney, we picked up two or three Royal Australian Navy. They're all part of the British Navy, but they're
Aussies.
They're very proud of their being Aussies. They picked us up for escort, because then we were in Japanese territory.
Sure were.
Japanese had already bombed Darwin, which is way up in the north.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And they had to, the entrance of the harbor, there's cliffs. They call them, like in England, the White Cliffs of Dover.
Yes.
And I don't know, maybe you've been there.
No.
But anyhow, what happened was the Australians, they had nets across that, submarine nets.
Yeah.
And geez, they started to pull in the nets, and they pulled them in, and we were all looking out of a few portholes and didn't know what the hell was going on. And then we went into the inner harbor, but what was there was, shortly before we had arrived, the Japanese Navy had arrived, and they had sent in a two-man submarine.
No.
Because they had some intelligence to the fact that the Queen Mary, not the Queen Elizabeth, but the Queen of Mary was in that harbor with 6,000 to 8,000 men on it. And the Jap says, this is a real opportunity. If we plug that with one torpedo.
Yeah.
So what happened was when they got inside the submarine nets, which were then closed, the Japs come up with a sub. And in Sydney Harbor on the southwest side is Sydney proper. Across the harbor on the other side is a community, a city like Oakland.
Uh-huh.
The two, in fact, Sydney dash Manly is the name of the city on the other side. And San Francisco, or Sydney and Manly had the same relationship as San Francisco and Oakland do. Uh-huh. They're very parallel.
Yeah.
And so up comes the sub. Nobody tells the skipper of the Manly Ferry that there's a goddamn war going on. And he comes sailing around with all these people on board. The Japs fire, and they hit the troop, we'll call it a troop carrier. It was a former luxury liner. Well, by this time, it happens there were a number of warships in that harbor moored. Among them, the USS Chicago, which is a small battleship. Well, the skipper of the Chicago got excited and ordered general quarters, and so the gunners went to the guns, and they started firing. They were shooting great big guns, 5 inches at least, in the middle of the damned harbor. And, of course, a big harbor. But the people on that ferry were headed home from work in Manly. And fortunately, they only clipped part of the Manly ferry. Ugh. And boy, all the warships, little light destroyers and everything that were in the harbor, they all opened up immediately. It was like a fraternity brawl. And
what a nightmare.
But yeah, they got the sub and sunk her. In fact, years later, when we got there, the Australian Navy had divers down. They were trying to bring it up.
Uh-huh.
They brought up the bodies, and the Japs have funny customs. Like, for instance, they trim a deceased soldier's fingernails and mail them to his family as part of the Bushido or something. I don't know their religious beliefs. Well, anyhow, in we went, and we went out in big double-decker buses like in London.
Uh-huh.
And they took us out in the country, and geez, it was cold. It was in June 1943, I think. And we got out. There was the Aussies are great on tennis and horse racing.
Yes.
There's a great racetrack outside of Sydney. What the hell was it called? I can't remember. But anyhow, I remember they had an oyster bar in the middle of the racetrack.
Ooh.
And then because it's a great fishing area.
Sure.
So we went out there, and boy, was it cold. We had left San Francisco with a mild climate, and we were shaken with a cold down there.
Well, it was their winter, wasn't it?
Oh, it was the reverse of us.
That's right.
So, and geez, that was one of the coldest nights I ever spent in my life. Well, our headquarters, they're waiting to find out where is this battalion going to go and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
The usual military details. And so we were there in Sydney while the officers went in for briefings and all this kind of thing. And it was quickly ascertained and gossiped that we were headed for a place called New Guinea.
Oh, my gosh.
And that was a place that nobody in our world had ever heard of.
Right.
But it was the second largest island in the world. Only Greenland is bigger. And when I say Greenland, you think of just a snow-capped nothing. Greenland is a big place.
Yes.
And so we cruised around Sydney Harbor for a while, and finally somebody got the word, and we started moving north, this ship with all these troops. And we moved north under the protection of a French warship.
Uh-huh.
And we could see the sailors, and they had those... You ever seen a French sailor?
Yes,
they had the striped shirts.
Yes.
And then they have a hat with a little...
Yes.
Red fuzzy...
Yes.
Wool. And so off we went on... They were guarding us, and there were several other ships. There were a couple of destroyers. Because by this time, the American Navy had wised up that there was a war on.
Uh-huh.
And... and the Japanese had sent airplanes as far south as Sydney. There had been some bombing of way up north of Darwin and some bombing down around Sydney. And Sydney was, they had put sandbags around all the store windows and everything. And they had what they called a brownout.
Yes.
They wanted to... avoid what had happened on the eastern coast of the United States, where the German submarines came up and used our traffic signals as a signal.
Yeah.
To fire on our own shores. Well, this time that didn't work. The Aussies were fast. They browned out everything down in that area, all the way down to Bondi Beach. Well, anyhow, the next thing I did with our convoy was we moved north. And past Brisbane, and then we were docked or moored temporarily off Townsville, Queensland.
Now, are you still the same rank?
Oh, yeah. No, I think it was I might have been a PFC or a corporal by then. I can't remember.
Okay.
And all I remember was our pay technically got increased a little bit. A private got something like $50 or $75 a month, and a corporal got about $10 more.
Uh-huh. Goody, goody.
And the other thing is, in the early days of the war, nobody had any authority to promote anybody.
Oh, I see.
And it was in a state of flux. And nobody knew how many openings and slots there were and how many divisions we were going to have.
Yeah.
So officers and enlisted men alike all... had to live with it. Well, from Townsville, we finally got on a ship again. And we headed north over one of the most beautiful bodies of water I've ever seen. And we came up that inland reef, the Great Barrier Reef. Mm-hmm. And it was like a movie. You could look down, lean over the side of the ship, and you could see these. And the dolphins would pace the ship up at the bow like this, you know. So we kept on going until, lo and behold, we're in range of Port Moresby, which was the principal place we were headed.
Mm-hmm.
This was not the capital of New Guinea. New Guinea was... at that time was 2/3 Dutch and 1/3 English. The English part, after World War I, had been taken over by the British under the authority of the League of Nations,
mm-hmm.
not the UN. There wasn't any UN.
Right.
And the nearest developed community was Merauke, Merauke. And that was the capital of the whole part that was under the British control.
I see.
And we didn't go into Merauke because it was such a good target. So instead we went to Port Moresby.
Uh-huh.
And not very far inland, maybe 10 miles, started the Owen Stanley range of mountains that ran like the spine of that whole huge island. And that began one of the serious parts of the war for which we were totally unprepared. We didn't know anything about jungle fighting or anything.
Uh-huh.
And Wisconsin's 32nd Division was brought in. They had been landed up at Townsville.
Uh-huh.
At a place called Cairns, C-A-I-R-N-S.
Uh-huh.
And they came in, and also elements of the 41st Infantry, which was also a National Guard division, from Oregon and Washington.
And
so here's the 41st Division, here's the 30th. They had to do it. One way to get through those mountains, through Cocoda Pass. I've been through it. And you got to understand, this is really untapped, savage country.
Mm-hmm.
There's no gas stations. There's no restrooms. There's no nothing except jungle and Japanese.
Yeah.
Fortunately, the Japanese Army was facing the same logistical problems we were. They were coming in the north side of the island, and we were coming up from the south.
Now, after you got off the ship.
So, oh boy, did we ever. And greeted by a Japanese bombing force.
Oh, really? And so what you were.
The first greeting I had at Fort Moresby was the Japs were on us with bombers. And we went up through Cocoda Pass and over the pass. And I've got books up at my home in Connecticut showing sketches that were made and tried to reconstruct it, and some pictures. It was, guys came down with dysentery, they came down with malaria. That was the beginning of real jungle warfare, just like Guadalcanal.
So you
but we never got any credit for nothing.
Yeah. Did you get out of the ship and immediately had to jump into foxholes?
We got shot at trying to get up. And the only way we knew how to get there was to go over through
the pass.
Through the pass. And this is a part of the war that, well, you get books and writings about it down in the Southwest, but not in the United States. They were so preoccupied with knocking off Hitler.
Yeah.
They didn't care if we all died on the vine down there in New Guinea. Nobody even knew where New Guinea was.
Yeah.
But we lost a lot of people. And
were you ever wounded?
No, I was not. But I had the usual ailments. Jungle rot, for instance.
Sure, sure.
And they put Jensen Violet on you. The Aussies knew how to handle it. We didn't. We'd never had anything like that.
Yeah.
And I also had dengue fever, where you think every bone in your body is breaking.
Yes.
And but finally, we began to get some support. And it was decided to load a lot of combat troops around the end of New Guinea and go up the northern coast and hit them from behind.
I see.
And that's when the Battle of Milne Bay took place. M-I-L-N-E. Milne was a famous naval guy from the British side.
Uh-huh.
And as I remember. And there was a fierce battle at Milne Bay, and it was really funny. It was an engineer's war. The engineers are bifurcated people. They know how to fight. They know how to use bayonets or anything else. But they also know how to do things like build bridges.
Yeah.
And so they came up the north side. By this time, our people had broken through the pass.
Uh-huh.
At I'm trying to remember the names now. I've got all this down because I've got books that recite it. But when you go through Cocoda Pass on the far side, there had been a handful, I'm talking about 100 people, Australians are there because it was gold.
Oh.
Gotcha. New Guinea had never been tapped. And these guys are up there digging around for gold, and suddenly they were hit from behind by the Japanese. Then we were hit from behind when we hit the Japanese.
Yeah.
And when you come down out of that west side, or on north side, it opens down into a huge plain.
Uh-huh.
And big, tall kunai grass, 14 feet high. You get in it, you can't even call for artillery fire because you don't know where anybody is.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to remember, I think it was the 162nd Infantry, which was a division of a part of the 32nd Division. Uh-huh. And also the Australian 7th Division. They were Imperial troops. The Australian Army was divided into two parts, kind of like ours. They had the Australian Army Force, and then they had, there was the, oh geez, I'm getting hazy, and I used to know this stuff, so, and I've got it all on print, but not here. The AIS is the Australian Imperials.
I gotcha.
And the ATF is the Australian Territorial Force.
I see.
You could smell right away that that's equivalent of the National Guard.
Yes.
The other one is ready to go. Well, by this time, the Japanese were coming down, you go way north to the Malay Peninsula. They're coming down through toward Singapore.
Yeah.
And, in fact, they took Singapore. And the horrible death marches in that process, I don't even want to talk about.
Well, now, during this time, you know, did you have specific duties, or were you just one of the infantry?
Yeah, well, we were fighting a dual role. They needed engineer help.
Yes.
But they also needed combat troops, because yes, they didn't have very many of them.
Yeah.
So we wound up doing things that normally, while engineers are trained to fight, not to the extent we were. We were really the auxiliary infantry to try and hold these places.
Yeah.
And we went through the pass, and as they used to say, over the hump, and we came down into this big valley with all the kunai grass. And then beyond that valley on the north coast was a community called Lae, L-A-E.
Uh-huh.
It had been a copra trading place where they brought in copra from the plantations. And that's on the north coast. And just prior to us getting there, coming up by boat, through, we had a, I wasn't in that part of it because my unit was headed strictly for Lae, but there are a whole series of small communities up and down that north coast. Dobadura, and I can't remember all of them. But when we got to Lae, our bombers, although limited in number, had come over and bombed the hell out of Japanese planes. And it was, I've got pictures of those, I'll show you. They were knocked off, and Lae is in the hook of a place called the Finchhoven, and the Huon, H-U-O-N Peninsula, and it was a good place to muster troops and so forth. So we went into Lae, and there was the other units of the 32nd Division had some terrible fighting, a place called Buna Mission. And it was hand-to-hand and all. It wasn't anything like Europe with big tanks. And I might stop here and say this. There are two big things about the Pacific War and the European War. Number one, there was, at the first two-thirds of the war, there were no tanks or heavy artillery. You couldn't move it in the jungle, and we didn't have it, to be honest about it. Whereas in Europe, right from the beginning, they had tanks. They were in a tanker's war. And so what they did was one thing, and the way they did it was likewise part of that. We had to operate a jungle war. It was like, well, we were closer to the techniques of Guadalcanal than we were to anybody running around the Britain Peninsula in Europe.
Sure.
And so we laid in at, we were attacked by air any number of times at Lae.
And so your units frequently.
I'll tell you this. I got up to go take a leak.
Yeah.
And down the valley, that's the Ramu Valley. Ramu, incidentally, in Melanesian means death. In the native tongue.
Really?
And so we had part of our people spread all along a ridge, and I was in that, and I was kind of pretty much all alone, when all of a sudden these goddamn planes showed up with big red balls on them.
Yeah.
And they started to... And with, down below us were the planes, our planes, that they were going to use in an attack. And the Japs were trying to nail them before they got a chance to do anything. I was so close to that guy from here to, well, maybe out to the street. And I could see him inside that bubble. He was looking out at us.
Really?
Now, the reason they obviously left, they had a bunch of us that they could have sprayed. I think they were out of ammunition and gas.
Uh-huh.
And so they turned around and went home. Their home base would have been Sansapor.
Uh-huh.
Which was way up the coast.
So?
Well, needless to say, it was a case of them. We never thought they'd come that close.
Yeah.
Immediately, they sandbagged everything around this area.
Uh-huh.
Heavy machine guns went in.
Yeah.
And practice firing, and we were all prepared for the enemy that wasn't there because they had moved west.
Yeah.
The bungling that goes on in a war is incredible. Yeah. Intelligence is never perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
And one thing that we had happen there that I have never seen in the books, our first mental cases of warfare.
Yes.
When we were up on that ridgeline, our particular company...
What company was it?
Hmm?
What was the name of the company?
I don't remember. I think it was... I'll tell you what it was. It was B... It was either B Company or C Company.
Okay.
Of the 1881st.
Okay.
And the first thing I discovered up there was... with this bombing and strafing that was going on, some of the guys broke.
Yeah.
And it's funny, the things you remember. There was a guy named Willie Streeter who was in... Willie was in B Company, maybe C. I think it was B. And somebody came running up to me. I think by then I was a corporal.
Uh-huh.
I was the nearest thing to an officer they had. So I said, "Hey, Van, the Strader's gone off the cliff." I went down there and, geez, he was in a tent. He had a full compliment. We all had full compliment of the gear, but he was wearing his. He had a steel helmet on and strings of ammunition on him and all this stuff. And he sat there and he was looking straight ahead. And in effect, he was saying the Japs are coming and we're going to hit them. Well, geez, our guys, finally one of the senior sergeants who was an old-time regular Army guy showed up with an officer and they carted Willie off. He never came back. He went to the Section 8.
Yeah.
They sent him back to Australia.
But you saw that in other...
Oh, the next one was a real surprise. Then we began to get a few replacements.
Uh-huh.
And the 41st Division had been in some very heavy fighting along with the Australian 7th, those two units, the Australians and the 32nd had kind of laid back.
Yeah.
And they had a guy who got a battlefield commission.
Uh-huh.
This also happened at Lee. And he was commissioned a second lieutenant and was there. And he stayed there until we went in the attack on Sansapor.
Uh-huh.
And then he refused to go in the assault. So they hauled him off to the loony bin. So I saw an enlisted man. I saw an officer. There may have been others. I can't tell you how many miles we're talking about here.
Yeah.
And there are 800 men roughly in a unit like that, and there may have been others that I didn't even know.
Yeah.
And so Willie was taken away. And the battalion had some minor construction to do in connection with the airstrip down the ravine. uh-huh. where the Ramu River comes down and then goes out into the Markham Valley and into the ocean. And it was pretty obvious that there wasn't much for us to do. We built a few little things that they needed. Then something happened. I knew that we were in for, this was no airplane exercise. Several officers came through, majors and lieutenant colonels. They want to know how many, they went through the gun list, how many new machine guns do you need? You know, A4s, how many this and that. Suddenly dawned on me, they're not giving us all that stuff just to keep us busy. These guys are preparing this unit for an attack. And you see, it was so flexible, and nobody knew who was in command. People say, well, where's your combat infantry badge? Jeez, I don't even want to worry about how many times I got shot at it.
Yeah.
But it was, the Pacific War was just a mess. And some of my best friends from Wisconsin, Bob Hughes, who got to be a general, and he's dead now. The old timers that were there in the Ramu Valley and in the Markham Valley. Anyhow, they took us down to Finchhoven, which is sort of a port on the Hulan Peninsula, Fort Lee. And we went down there and we laid in there a few days. And then they assembled the attack fleet, which was the 32nd Division and the 41st. And I'll never forget the commander of the total task force was a guy who'd been a private in the Spanish-American War, a general. He's a very able man, very brave. And they had set up loudspeakers all along the beach. And he gave everybody, we were all with packs of ammunition, we were loading. There wasn't any practice crap. I was carrying live grenades on my back.
Yeah.
And we knew then that they were going to commit us to a fight. And geez, everybody was getting juggle rot. It was terrible. Well, they put us on a couple of ships. And we proceeded up the coast. It was about 14 days. I slept on a steel deck.
The loudspeakers that they put on the beach, was that for an address to the troops?
Yes, it was, and I'll tell you what he said. General, it wasn't I.P. Swift, it was the other, there was a corps commander, a very bright guy, and he told me, he says, I'll tell you where you're going to hit it right in the balls. You know, you know, man, these are life and death. They're not on Fifth Avenue for a fashion parade.
Right.
And he said, we need prisoners for intelligence. So if you can catch one, grab them. But if there's any doubt about it, kill the son of a bitch. And that was exact words. I'll never forget. They said, kill the son of a bitch. And because, boy, they had given some of our people a really bad time, torture them and whatnot.
Yeah.
So off we went, and I think we were under I Corps at that time. I may be wrong on that. I'd have to have all my, you can't imagine stuff that somehow I smuggled into the U.S. Army mail service and it got all the way to Buffalo, New York. Geez, the postman used to go nuts at my mother and dad's place. And he says, geez, this big box came, there was a gun in it, and he says, hey, can I see it? And Dan said, yeah, you got a job, deliver the mail for crying out loud. But the guy came over that evening.
Did he?
To my parents' home, and my father, who knew something about guns, he took it about and reassembled it. And
what was it? Was it?
It was an Arisaka, 1895, Meiji. That was the emperor who was ruling in Japan.
Where'd you get it?
Where did we go? Well, when we went in an attack on Hollandia and at Sansapur, which the Japs had started to put on the edge of the jungle about 5 miles in, a pretty big air base. There's a big lake there called Sentani, Lake Sentani, and the Japs had even built a road about 4 miles of it from the landing beaches into where the flat land was that they were going to use. And I'll tell you this much. We were briefed about 14 days out. A transport ship going on an attack has divided the Company A, Company B, and so forth. So, and then they filter it down to the sergeants that are running the squads or platoons. Is that our phone?
No, it's mine.
That's Rudy. So, where was I? Oh, yeah. So what happens is the officers were briefed.
Yeah.
They knew where we were going. The only problem was they didn't have any maps that were worth a nickel because that had never been, that part of the world had never been touched. Even Margaret Mead in the National Geographic had never been there. Nobody had been there. It was just absolutely one of the last place on the face of the globe. But the officers briefed us, and I'll forget two things. They gave us a hot meal. The Navy has very good cooking facilities on any ship they have. They're very good. And you know what the big prize was? Boiled potatoes. And I like potatoes. A lot of people don't. But we had boiled potatoes and beans.
Really?
That was our execution meal. And then everybody checked their guns, oiled them, made sure they were working, et cetera, et cetera. And then about 5 o'clock in the morning, maybe, they moved the attack vessels with all these troops on them in a line. And the warships were with the Enterprise that's caused a big stink in the last few days in the paper. The Enterprise, it was the last aircraft carrier we had afloat in the U.S. Navy.
Yeah.
The Japs had gotten all the rest of them up at Pearl Harbor, and they missed three of them that were way the hell out at sea and not available. So they had us all, and you'd line up four guys, and they'd throw over, you and I might call them a cargo net. They're knitted rope.
Right.
They're about like this. The Navy called them save-alls because a wounded guy or anybody could grab one of those easily and maybe get saved.
Uh-huh.
Well, they lined us up against the railing, you know, four deep all the way back. And then at 0600, I'll never forget that, the first rockets went up. Phew! And they were firing rockets off the ships.
Uh-huh.
At what we knew were Japanese positions.
Yeah.
And over the top. You know, we had two things with us that were kind of interesting. You've heard of President Kennedy and his PT boats. Well, they were there. And boy, I watched them. They were firing off the bow of those PT boats right into the Japanese positions. And so the next thing was we went over.
You went over the side.
If you missed and dropped in the ocean, I was carrying probably 60, 70 pounds on my back, and I was a little kid.
Yeah.
And I knew I'd never make it if I didn't. And some friendly hands down in the assault boats grabbed me and pulled me in, and we hit the beach. We went in like MacArthur walking in the water. That was exactly where it was, about up to our knees.
Uh-huh.
And in the meantime, the Navy had all kinds of signals. They started firing 5-inch guns over our heads and into the Japanese positions. That's a real thrill.
And so what island was that?
That's on the north coast of New Guinea.
New Guinea.
Sansipor.
Uh-huh.
Was the name of the place. That was Dutch New Guinea.
Yes.
And we had, with our battalion, which was the lead battalion, we had three Dutch officers with us. They were the first Dutch military to recover from the enemy land which had been seized during the early days of the war.
I'll be darned.
And these Dutch guys are pretty tough. And anyhow, we went in, and a couple of funny things happened. Not funny, but interesting. You get a sandy beach, and these pictures you see on TV are pretty accurate, showing a sandy beach. And then comes a mangrove swamp about,
yes,
well, 50 feet in.
Yeah.
Well, what the Japs did was, of course, they built fortifications in that mangrove swamp to nail us when we were,
yeah,
making that 50-foot run. And so I'm on my face, and we were sort of firing at random. You couldn't see them. I got a couple of pictures of a Jap I shot right there. I've got them here in the house. That's for some reason that I was able to save that one. There was a combat cameraman with us. And in the midst of all this, I said to the guy, hey, where's my pictures? You know, I was ready to cry.
Yeah.
He says, I'll give you one. And he had a little funny box. He developed it right then. He says, here you are, soldier. And
no,
I
kidding.
Stuck it in my pack. And yeah, I got all the way to this house.
That's amazing.
Oh, it is utterly amazing. And anyhow, who comes walking down the beach? You'll never guess. Douglas MacArthur. And geez, there was firing going on, you know. It was.
Yeah.
And there was a guy next to me, I don't even remember who he was. He says, thank goddamn fool general is going to get killed here. And I said, well, it's his life. And he said, no, it's all our lives because he's in command.
Yeah.
And he kept walking. He only had two officers with him. He was wearing khakis and that crazy cap that he,
yes,
always wore.
Yes.
And by this time, the planes from the Enterprise were really raising hell up and down the coast. And so they didn't, MacArthur ignored it. He was a brave guy, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
And ultimately we got to, when things cooled off and we had fanned out and made a big perimeter around this area so that our planes could come in.
Yeah, yeah.
And because up to then it had been Navy fighters.
Uh-huh.
And so we were at Sansipor. We got bombed there a lot. A lot of stray Jap stragglers got knocked off.
How long were you there?
I'm trying to remember. That was in, I've got some notes on this, but they're not. See, this wasn't my home. I stored everything in my,
yeah,
up north.
Well, if you have like some notes or some pictures,
oh,
what,
yeah,
we can,
I'll
do.
I'll give you one picture this morning. I won't give it to you, but I'll show you one.
All right. Okay. And I was going to say, we've got a wonderful videographer who can either.
I had to have this one restored because they yell.
Oh, yes.
And I almost got killed there. The chaps then knew we were in there, and they would come down from a place called Walk the Island and bomb us. The Army, in its ignorance, issued jungle hammocks to everybody. Nobody in his right mind would ever start a war and with,
yeah,
combat troops in the jungle. The Marines did not.
Yeah.
We did not, except at Sansipor, you take the jungle hammock, which was rolled in a pack, you unroll it, and there's a little bit of rope, and you tie it on a tree on each end. It had a zipper, and it was all enclosed, and you got into it. The problem was there was no way to get to a foxhole to get safe if you got jumped in that thicket.
Yeah.
Next thing I know, there were some of them coming in real close.
Yeah.
And You know what I did?
Why?
I couldn't get, you know, early in the Army, they used to say if you lost a nail, you'd have to find a saving of charges for that.
Yeah.
In wartime, anything goes. If you lose a truck, fine, blow it up.
Yeah.
They don't care. Well, they couldn't do anything about that, so I couldn't get out. The zipper stuck.
Oh.
So I smashed that, and I got free. And jumped to the ground, and I threw it away. Everybody in my battalion threw away their jungle hammocks.
Yeah.
And I never saw one even after that.
When you were in New Guinea, what would you say is one of your typical days?
I don't know. It's hard to say because we were doing different things. The first thing that causes all the confusion is I was in an independent battalion, which in an amphibious warfare is very important. You can detach and attach.
I see.
You don't have to move a whole division with 20,000 guys.
Yeah.
You might have a strong point, and you've got a battalion there. You pull off two companies and say, go kill them.
Yeah.
And that's a different... It isn't like Europe.
Right.
And so a typical day might be shooting or sleeping.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they came over and really hit us hard. And geez, if they didn't hit one of their ammunition dumps, everything went up. I thought I was going up, but I survived that. I've got some pictures there. And they started dropping, they got some American B-17s and they started dropping food to us. Well, they had just brought out, we'd been living on what called K rations, which really aren't a ration at all. They're kind of, there's a three meals a day. There's a kind of a candy bar and a can of dog food and whatnot. They started dropping one called a 10-in-1, meaning it was adequate for 10 men.
I see.
And there'd be, some of the things I remember, they had canned rice pudding that was very good.
Uh-huh.
And then there'd be a can of tomatoes. The argument always was that if you had a squad down there with six or eight guys that were alive, who was going to get the tomatoes? Well, I can't stand tomatoes. Well, then how about the rice? And
yeah.
In the meantime, the Japs are going,
yeah.
Wondering if you're nuts, you know. We were. And
did you have a medic with your unit?
A medic?
Uh-huh.
Yes, we did. In fact, we were, a battalion would carry a medical squad. Sometimes more than that, reinforced.
Yeah.
There were two guys in my battalion, not in my company, because in the war, the guys get all mixed up.
Sure.
The guys from A Company wind up on the ground and with C Company, and nobody knows where the hell their outfit is.
Yeah.
It's complicated. And anyhow, there were two college graduates in that battalion. They weren't in my company. They were both from Lexington, Kentucky. One's name was Geddes, Herbert Geddes. And the other one was William Forston Jr. Forston, F-O-R-S-T-O-N. Geddes got hit bad. I heard him scream.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of profanity and whatnot. And he got yelling, like, kill those fuckers, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of bad news. And Geddes, I realized, was seriously wounded. He had taken a big shrapnel hit. Right? He was diving for a hole, and a Jap mortar round came in, and that was it.
Yeah.
It didn't kill him. But the medics wore A1.
I've heard that over and over again. Over and over again.
I don't want to talk about that too much.
Well, you're certainly not the first one. You know, it's...
Oh, no, I've got a photograph showing about a dozen graves being dug. That was just where one shell hit.
Yeah.
I've got another picture, and isn't here, that one is up north, showing the guys with the decorations.
Yes.
They're wearing fatigues and everything. But out of 800 men, there must have been, well, there must have been 30 of them had been wounded or... And, of course, there were guys that deserved the Purple Heart that were dead.
Sure.
And other guys that were seriously wounded, and they were in a hospital, had been evacuated. So, anyhow, Geddes disappeared, and Bill Forson disappeared. And the reason they were close to me, I was one of the few guys the whole outfit had been to college.
Sure.
And that was kind of a bond. And... then, well, after that, this could take some time because I was really in the thick of it. I don't mean to be a phony hero, but I'm telling you, every day is a year. Uh-huh. And so after things calmed down, and it was very pleasant there at Sansifor when you got up and then out of the savanna into the it was beautiful, like a magic forest. It wasn't any jungle anymore because you were getting higher.
Uh-huh.
Finally, you get higher enough. There was snow on the mountains in the Vandenberg Range, and that was 37 miles south of the equator. And I never thought I'd see that, but I did. And, well, anyhow, after a while, that was over. We got hit a lot. We were bombed a lot. And... meanwhile, the 41st went further up the coast in another landing at Wakhti, and that stopped the Jap from coming down.
I see.
And then we had to saddle up again and go back to Hollandia after we went up to Sansifor. And attacked that place.
Uh-huh.
And that was a pushover because there was really not much there. We went back to Hollandia where they refitted the outfit. That is, you got more ammunition, guns, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And off we went, and they handed, I'll show you a thing, that we were going to the Philippines. This was important because they used to say the way home is through victory. The ships traveled, there's something called the Mindanao Depths. It's 7 miles deep. It's the deepest part of the ocean that's ever been tapped.
Uh-huh.
And we went right over the Mindanao Depths to land on Leyte. That was our first, that's the famous picture of MacArthur walking ashore.
Uh-huh.
And we went in, and interestingly enough, the Japanese never attacked us the first 2 days. But they did after that.
Uh-huh.
And I could tell you stories about the fighting on Luzon.
Well, that's
again,
what this
it
is
was
about.
Complicated because everybody says, what were engineers doing? I said, my answer was they were trying to build a goddamn bridge while they were being shot at, so they shot back.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like the artillerymen can't do that. Engineers are the only dual-trained people fight and work. And, geez, I could tell you stories about, and on Luzon.
Well, tell me some.
Well, after we went into Luzon, into Leyte, I'm sorry, there's a road runs from... the point where we landed, when I say we, teasers, units spread out over several miles.
Yeah.
And that road goes in straight, it's a dirt road, and then it ends because there's some rice fields up here and on each side. Over on the right is the capital of Leyte. which is Tacloban.
Uh-huh.
And it was a provincial capital. It was a pretty modern building. And two days later, we had to go up that road and down then to the next village south, which was Palo, P-A-L-O.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of streams in there, and they wanted engineers, and they wanted guys that knew how to shoot. And so when we turned left and started down on the right-hand side, you never move infantry troops in a group. They're always single file with two files, one on each side of the road, so you don't get clobbered all at once.
Yes.
And there were, I would guess, maybe 200 bodies, Japanese. 2 days in that tropical sun, and they were bloated. And the buttons, they had brass buttons on their lightweight tunics, and they popped.
I'll be darned.
And, we got into Palo, and it was a terrible hand-to-hand fight there. And anyhow, I saw some pretty grisly stuff. The Japs sent a unit down on the north side of the river. Our guys were at the bridge. And the Japs put a bunch of Filipino civilians in front of them.
Oh.
An old trick. They did that in Korea too, by the way.
Yeah.
And they went at it with knives. There wasn't room to really use rifle. They were at it, clubbing each other. And when I got there with my squad, it was really over, except their bodies lying around. And one guy, one Jap, ours and theirs, one Jap had been hit. And he was stretched out on the ground. And he next to him was an American who was a nice guy. He and a fellow named Pilgrim had been together ever since they got drafted at Fort Bliss, Oklahoma. And the Jap had bayoneted him. And I can't remember whether it was Pilgrim or the other guy, but they were very close, and they had been very lucky. They hadn't gotten hit up to that point.
Excuse me.
And they, the Jap took, there was a rifle laying there, and he took it, and he hit him on the head until he killed him. And people were yelling and screaming and swearing like you'd never believed. And I sat down and I was pretty sick to my stomach.
To have seen all of that.
I was no hero. But anyhow, our guys took the bridge and built a replacement so the rest of the troops could move through there. And I'll show you a few pictures right now. I might as well. After that, the Luzon business is kind of different. At Luzon, for the first time, we broke into the open where they could use field artillery.
I see.
Up to then, it was man-to-man and machine guns and grenades. I'll go get these. They're right here in the next room.
Okay, shall I put this on hold for a minute?
For a minute. Now, anyhow, okay. I'll tell you a story.
You were going to tell me a story.
We're on the beach at Hollandia in Dutch New Guinea, away from here.
Yeah.
And I heard there was a lot of fire. The destroyers were firing 5-inch guns over our heads. Guys yelling and shouting and swearing and somebody yelling, medic, 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 which is what wounded men always call.
Yeah.
And I looked up, and guys are mixed up. Here was some guys from C Company, which wasn't where I belonged.
Yeah.
But in a war, where you're shooting, you don't stop and say, hey, let me see your ID card. Christ, you're going to be kidding.
Yeah.
And there was a guy lying on his face, and he was screaming, medic, medic, medic. And it was Herb Geddes. He was, if I can use the word, a stunning young man. He and Bill Forson, who was in another company, A Company, clung to one another. They were the only two college people other than me, you know. Well, the chaplain didn't want that, but...
And these were the medics?
No, Geddes was a lying gentleman.
I gotcha.
But the two medics came up and he was screaming, I'm hit, I'm hit. And boy, was he ever. You could put your hand in the back of his back. Goddamn shrapnel was awful stuff.
Yeah.
In fact, more casualties from shrapnel than from small arms fire. And anyhow, they hustled him off and put him, they had LSTs. They put him on a one that was used as a temporary medical thing.
Uh-huh.
Well, the war went on. And later on, after the Battle of Leyte, now this was in Dutch New Guinea I was talking about.
Yeah.
But then came the invasion of Leyte, and I was in that up to my eyeballs. And we had settled down. We had a lot of troops committed, I know, 70,000 or something like that, several divisions up in the hills away from the coast of Leyte. And we had settled down in a coconut grove and had gone into semi-retirement because we had plenty of rooms up front. They never would have broken through that line. And so I'm wearing khakis now because we weren't wearing greens. We were wearing khakis, not fatigues. And a Jeep pulled up and there were a driver and three officers in it. And I got to tell you, when a guy was hit in New Guinea, you got to see these maps and know what you're talking about. Way over here and down here were the French islands. You've seen the movie with, who the hell was it, Julie Andrews or somebody?
Yeah.
Gotta get that man out of my hair. Well, that's Noumea.
Yeah.
Down in that area. And our people refused to remove wounded people to the United States. Because if they did and the guy recovered, they couldn't get a replacement. They were all going to Europe to kill the Germans.
I see.
So they wouldn't let him go. And so, but Geddes was obviously so badly wounded that I couldn't imagine him not sending this guy to the States to some big hospital like Letterman or whatnot. But anyhow, here I am on the edge of the road at our cantonment on Leyte, and who's there but a Jeep with two or three officers, I can't remember how many. They were all full colonels. And I came up, the senior colonel gruffly says to me, where's the commanding officer of this outfit? I said, that's Colonel Capes. He's right up here. So I took him up to where we had a command tent. And he says, Colonel Capes? Yeah. Do you know Corporal Geddes? Yes. He said he was killed. He said he wasn't killed. He's right here on this island. But he's in terrible pain and he doesn't belong here. He couldn't pee. He was in such pain. It was just awful. He said, I want to see your medical officer. So we had we hauled in two captains who were, one of them had been a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School. They took one look at him. They said, put him on a plane. Geddes' father was a guy named Chandler. Well, his father was, his father was a good friend of a guy named Chandler, who then was governor of Kentucky, Happy Chandler.
Uh-huh.
You might have heard of him. These years have passed. But what happened was when he got wounded, all he got was a War Department. In those days, it was a War Department. Telegram that said your son has been wounded in action.
Yeah.
That's all. Well, Geddes' father, as I say, was a good friend of Chandler, who then was about to be a U.S. senator.
Yeah.
And the Geddes' went over to the Chandlers and they said, "What happened?" They got a report.
Yeah.
Geddes was on a plane on a C-47 that afternoon.
Where did they take him?
They took him, Letterman, I think, and what's the one, Reed.
Walter Reed.
That's the one right in the nation's capital. And he got over it and he lived. But he was a mess. And until about, after I... I came here in 72. Well, that's just... You've got their usual robbery for pills. Where was I?
You were saying that he went to Walter Reed and he lived.
Yeah, I went to Walter Reed and I never heard him. But Forston was also in that fight. And for every Christmas, for over 20 years, I would get a Christmas card to me signed that said, "For days we will never forget." And he signed it. I'm sure he's been dead. He'd be in his 90s now.
Well, it's amazing to me how many who were in battles like that, who were wounded, who, you know, are still around to, and I think that's why we're in such a rush to try to...
And our memories are getting weak.
Well, it's time to capture those memories and put them down to be part of the historical picture.
Up in Essex, it was a retired two-star admiral. That's the vice admiral.
Who is?
Irwin Chase, Jr. And he commanded in the latter days of the war, he commanded the Ticonderoga, an aircraft carrier.
Yeah.
They were ordered out on a run against the coast of Japan. It was just one ship of a big chain of ships that was going to shell the hell out of And they were hit by kamikazes. The first one came in, and there's a side thing on a carrier called, the island.
Yes.
The first one came in and right into the island. And Irwin Chase, better known as Mike, a nickname, said it hit the island. And of course, the commander, the admiral, was there, and two senior officers. And I said, "What happened?" He said, "He died in my arms." They got the ship back to, I think it was Truk, and then they went to Honolulu, the Pearl. And Mike was an interesting guy. He was a graduate of Annapolis, class of 22. And he and I have sat around.
Now, is this the person who's...
we're getting back to Guinness.
Yeah.
Obviously, when the treatment received at a clearing station was totally inaccurate. And but they got her bone and they got him on the ladder. Now, what happened after that? And I apologize and apologize since I've been here. I should have written Bill Forreston. And I never have. But what I'm telling you is when individuals go through that, just one, it isn't just one day in the movies. The next day shows them 10 years later. It was day after day. You'd get out of the hospital, one leg half blown off, and they'd put you in the line. The other thing is, there was another series that was a semi-documentary called Band of Brothers.
Yes.
And I knew some of the guys. They all went to Europe with the 81st Airborne. And I knew some of them. But they had a bunch of live witnesses that survived the war who'd been in a lot of fighting.
Mm-hmm.
They'd interview them separately. Every single guy who was in his 80s, they couldn't finish the interview because they'd cry.
Those are...
I'll stop with it for now.
All right.